Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope everyone's been able to find a seat. There's plenty of chairs and tables out there. We have a full agenda this morning. I'm Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And you may or may not be aware of that Bernice Kandarian could not come down to the convention. But in her place is Donna Sanchez, who will say a few words in a few minutes. So I think you'll find this morning it's going to cover a variety of different aspects of access. We'll be talking about transportation and entertainment, the built environment, and also wayfinding access. So I'm going to turn over the mic to Donna Sanchez, who would like to say a few words before we begin. And I'm going to move the mic towards you, Donna.
It's hooked up.
Oops, I think I just pulled it out.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. On behalf of, I'm Donna Sanchez. I'm treasurer of a California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. On behalf of Bernice Kandarian, president, we hope that you enjoy this joint session of Access Committee on Access and Transportation and the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. And if anybody is interested in joining CCCLV, I would be more than happy to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Donna. And just to let everyone know, and that is there is a program supplement that will have in it the narrative description of the floor plan of the hotel, which we'll be interested in getting comments on later on, because there may be some little errors, and we apologize. The hotels you probably aware of and still can observe, there's some still work going on which we weren't fully aware of some of the things at the time, so was guessed. But the Junior Blind of America donated the services of putting together the description, and they've been extremely supportive, and we really want to express our appreciation to the Junior Blind of America. Okay. Yes. I got the mic right up against my mouth, practically. Okay. Also, in the program supplement, we have the vitas on many of our speakers, so that if you're interested in finding out about their backgrounds, you can consult that. Okay, so what the first item will be, ensuring access to modern transportation and entertainment. We have two attorneys with us, Lisa Elth, partner from Rosen Bean?
Bean?
Yes,
Bean. Thank you. And it's Galvin and Grandfell.
That's right.
Good. Okay. And they are, Lisa is a partner, Lisa Elz, and with her is Mike Newis, who is the associate. And I also heard that fade out, and yet I can't explain why it faded out. I haven't moved the mic. Okay, I would like to turn over the mic to Lisa to start their presentation.
I think I have one in front of me. Yeah. Can people hear me in this mic? Okay, I'll move it closer. Good morning, everyone. My name is Lisa Elz. I am a partner at a law firm called Rosen, Bean, Galvan, and Grunfeld. We're located in San Francisco. With me here is my associate, Mike Nunez. And our firm is a sort of unique blend of traditional commercial law and civil rights law. In particular, we have a long history of doing a lot of disability rights cases. In the 8 years that I've been there, among the cases that I've worked on are cases that ensure that prisoners within California prisons that have disabilities have full access to the programs and services within the prison, and that their needs are accommodated within the prison setting. That case has been going on now for over 20 years, and we're continuing to working on ensuring that the conditions within the system accommodate the needs of people with disabilities. We also work on a number of individual cases, some of which we're going to speak about today. And I personally have represented on appeal an individual who suffered injuries and interferences with his medical needs when state actors refused to accommodate his disability needs. So we have a long history of working on important cases for people with disabilities, and that includes commercial cases and Title III cases, as well as Title II, and we also have employment cases to make sure that people with disabilities are accommodated on the job as well. I'm going to turn it over to Mike to discuss the first area that we wanted to speak about today, which relates to modern transportation technologies.
Hi, everybody. It's nice to be here this morning. It's been, I think, 2 years since my last CCB convention, and I'm happy to be back with everyone. So all of you guys are here. That's great. That means you guys managed to get here. You came... well, so there are a variety of different ways, you know, folks travel. Sometimes it's paratransit, sometimes it's public transit, and then sometimes when you really need to get to another destination really quickly, you'll use a taxi or another similar service. The services I'm going to talk to you about today are Uber and Lyft. So many of you may be familiar with Uber. It's a modern taxi-like service that allows you to use a smartphone to request a vehicle that can take you door-to-door, picking you up from wherever you are and taking you to wherever you ask. And the system is really quite convenient and helpful, particularly for blind individuals, because the pricing is pretty competitive with, you know, when you compare it against taxis, and because the smartphone apps that you use to request vehicles are, for the most part, very accessible to screen reading technology on smartphones. So this is a very exciting development for people who are blind and people who have other types of disabilities. Unfortunately, the problem is that we have actually received quite a large number of complaints from blind folks who have guide dogs who have had the experience where drivers that have been sent to pick them up refuse to pick them up when they see that they have a guide dog. And so, for example, we've heard from one person who has had this happen to her 12 times. We've heard from another person who actually was with a friend who was almost struck by an open car door when the driver, you know, was speeding away to avoid transporting the two of them with their guide dogs. And then we heard from another person who was actually physically threatened by the driver when the blind individual tried to assert his right to travel in the car with his guide dog. So, you know, a lot of folks have had really very unfortunate and very negative experiences when trying to take a ride in an Uber vehicle. In fact, our records, which we've been keeping for this matter, now include over 100 instances where blind folks with guide dogs have been denied rides or otherwise discriminated against by Uber drivers. So we approached Uber about a year ago, a little over a year ago, and told them about this problem and asked that they work with us to negotiate a resolution. A resolution that would include changes to their policies and practices to make sure that other blind people with guide dogs were able to reliably access the really quite helpful transportation services that Uber is offering. Unfortunately, Uber wasn't willing to negotiate a resolution with us. So about this time last year, September 9th, 2014, we filed a lawsuit against Uber, you know, asserting that Uber was discriminating against blind folks with guide dogs. We brought the case on a California-wide basis, and the case has been moving forward since then. So you might be wondering to yourself, why would Uber refuse to have negotiated with us in the first place? So the answer to that is that Uber, throughout our conversations with Uber, Uber has taken the position that it's actually not a transportation provider. You know, despite the fact that you use your phone to launch an Uber app that requests an Uber car, they take the position instead that they're just a communications platform that happens to connect customers with independent contractors who are independent transportation providers in their terms. So Uber contends that it doesn't employ its drivers, that they're just independent contractors. And as such, that Uber can't control its drivers because they're just independent contractors. So that's the position they've taken all along. However, you know, the funny thing about this case is that although Uber has sort of resisted, initially at least, trying to tackle this problem head on, they're actually one of the best positioned companies providing taxi-like services to tackle this problem effectively. And the reason is twofold. On one point, of course, they can always add mandatory training for their drivers and offering that on a periodic basis. But beyond that initial point, Uber actually has a technological infrastructure with their app that allows them to identify and root out discriminatory drivers in a way that, in the past, taxi companies couldn't do or even come close to doing. So blind folks who use the Uber app can easily identify who the driver is that discriminates against them, because the iPhone app or the Android app will report and shows to the passenger the name of the driver, the type of vehicle they are driving, and their license plate number. And in addition, the technology that Uber has in its back-end system allows them to figure out which driver they sent to pick up a passenger and allows them to determine where the driver went. So Uber's actually in a great position to tackle this problem as long as they, you know, express a willingness to do so. In addition, Uber actually controls its drivers' access to its customers. So Uber actually also has the ability to discipline or to block access to the service if drivers discriminate against blind passengers with guide dogs. So I mentioned to you earlier that we filed the case last year. Initially, Uber tried to dismiss our case. They filed something called a motion to dismiss. And they basically argued that we didn't have the right to sue on behalf of this issue, on behalf of blind passengers. And they also argued that the ADA didn't apply to them because they were not a public accommodation. Fortunately for us, the judge agreed with our side and completely denied Uber's motion to dismiss. So that was in April, and since then we have been engaged in settlement talks with Uber. So we've held joint meetings with Uber, and most recently in August, a settlement mediation with Uber. And we have started to discuss concrete settlement proposals. But we're also not sure that we're going to settle the case at this point. So we're also moving forward with the litigation. Earlier this week, we submitted papers for the next step in the litigation called discovery, where the parties basically are asking for evidence from the other side to help prepare their case for trial. We have a trial date in this case set for mid-April of 2016. So if we aren't able to settle the case, then we're going to move forward aggressively with the litigation to make sure that we can actually tackle this problem one way or another. So now that I've just told you about the Uber matter, I just wanted to, before I turn it over to any Q&A that we have on this matter, I wanted to just mention that, you know, we are continuing to gather experiences and stories from blind folks out there with guide dogs who are being denied rides by Uber drivers or being otherwise discriminated against by Uber drivers, even if not completely denied a ride. So if you are a guide dog user and have experienced discrimination from Uber drivers, please come speak with us. We're going to have a table in the exhibit hall, or in the exhibit room, and we'll also provide our contact information in a little bit, so that way if you're not able to visit us in the exhibit room, you can either email us or call us. So with that, I wanted to open it up briefly to some questions and answers about Uber before we move on to the Lyft matter.
There's a mic being passed around.
Oh, good morning, Mitch.
Okay.
There we go.
They didn't want to hear my.
That's all right. Your comments about Uber are interesting because my stepson drives for Uber.
Sure.
And he's been driving for them for a year.
Uh-huh.
And after an unfortunate incident he had with a dog that, the dog wasn't well in his car, he stopped driving for a while. And when he inquired of Uber about such things, and he's been around guide dogs all his life, basically, he was told, if someone says it's a service animal, whatever it looks like, whatever it acts like, you take it. So, you know, as a former trainer, I know that there's usually a disconnect between what folks are trained to do and what they actually do when push comes to shove. But I thought you'd find that interesting. They, at least down here, are being told, whatever the passenger tells you, if they tell you it's a service animal or emotional support or whatever, you take the animal, and that's what he's doing. My question, though, when is there going to be litigation regarding the fact that most, at least to my knowledge, Uber drivers don't have accessible vehicles, which means that folks with mobility limitations are not able to use the service?
Sure, Mitch. So first, thanks so much for that comment. We are hearing sort of very inconsistent reports about sort of what drivers have been told, and this just adds to the tapestry, so I appreciate that. So regarding your question about physical access litigation, I actually believe that some physical access cases have been filed in other jurisdictions. I don't think there are any here in California. I believe one was filed in Texas, and it's called Ramos versus Uber. And it was actually against both Uber and Lyft. And that one settled, I believe, but I don't know the nature of the settlement. I think, in addition, that there have been or are just recently was a case filed, I want to say somewhere on the East Coast, but don't hold me to that because I'm not 100% sure if that's right, if it was Uber or another entity as the defendant in that case. But I know that at the very least, you know, if there isn't an active case right now trying to tackle the problem, that, you know, it's being certainly evaluated and considered within the disability rights legal community. I think one challenge with that kind of case that doesn't exist for the guide dog case is actually there are express limitations in Title III of the ADA that do not require, that have sort of lower standards of requirement for physical access with respect to taxis. And that was sort of the product of a legislative compromise when the ADA was passed.
Hi,
right back to your second. This gentleman's first. There you go, sir.
Thank you, Michael. Hi, Ken Metz. Down here, it was interesting because I've only taken three Uber rides now. Mm-hmm. And the first one was great. I got the notice, called out, and talked to the driver, told him I had a guide dog. I just wanted to avoid any problem, but he didn't have any difficulty. The second time, we rode without our dogs, my wife and myself, and we didn't bring the dogs because it was 105 outside, so we left them home for 2 hours. And coming home, I said, well, normally we'd have our guide dogs with. And he said, well, if you'd had dogs with you, I would never have picked you up. Now, the one advantage, a great one actually with Uber, is the fact that you do get the receipt with the driver's name and all that. I immediately wrote to the support group down here in L.A., and did get a response at least. Now, whether or not they talked to the driver, I have no idea, but they said they would, so I have to at least assume that unless I would ever meet that driver again. And then last night, we left the hotel here, took Uber, and absolutely no difficulty with both dogs in the vehicle. He may have been smoking some weed, but that was a whole different... But and that's a true story. I'm not kidding. But at least he didn't have a problem. Maybe that's why he had no problem with the dogs. I don't know.
Thanks. We have another question here. Here you go, Steve.
Hi, Steve Bauer, Greater LA Chapter. And this may or may not relate to the case that you're drawing, but I am a newbie to Uber. I'm not a dog user, but I've had very good luck. But I find with the new update to the iOS app that at least I have not found a way to text the driver anymore, which he used to be able to do, to contact the driver. Now, Ken said he did last night, although maybe I'm missing something, but is that a problem that others are having with not being able to contact the driver through the new update to the app?
So I actually did receive a notice in the past couple of days that the most recent update to the app has some sort of break in certain accessibility features, that Uber's already aware of that issue and is planning or has already submitted an update to the Apple Store that should fix it. But I think it's supposed to not come out until sometime next week. I'm not sure if this particular bug that you're referring to is the one that is being fixed, but I kind of want to sort of wait and see if it is the one that is going to be resolved, because if so, that'd be great. You know, it'll just remedy the issue that you've raised. But actually, you've pointed out another important point that I actually wanted to mention, which is, so the kind of remedies that we're looking for in this case as we move towards settlement include sort of a panoply of different sort of ways of getting at the problem. Some of it's about driver training. Some of it's about, you know, making sure drivers understand what a guide dog is and what a guide dog isn't. And some of it's about making sure that the process for submitting complaints is accessible consistently and is accessible through the various channels that are available to sighted customers. So for instance, we've received several complaints from blind people who have first been denied rides by an Uber driver, and then when they tried to report the problem, the discrimination, on the Uber website, they weren't able to submit the complaint form because the complaint form wasn't fully accessible. And so that's that's the kind of thing that we want to make sure that we're able to fix if we reach a sort of mutually agreeable settlement, or if we end up going to the litigation route. That's the kind of thing that we would want to tackle in that avenue as well.
We have another question over here.
Good morning, William Elliott, Fresno Chapter. I've 2 points. One is with regard to Uber providing the access to the drivers. It may be even solved by a simple, when they apply, have a tick box say, I accept dogs. And if they don't accept dogs and they know the person has a dog, then they don't send that driver. that could be a solution. My second point would be, as this problem also happened with pets, because if it has happened with pets, that it's not all right, but if it's only happening to people with guide dogs and other service animals, then that would be obviously a discrimination against disabled people in general.
Sure. So regarding your first point, that is actually one of that the idea of getting written affirmative assent from drivers to agree to transport service animals, including guide dogs, at the outset when they first sign up is one component of what we would like to see in a settlement agreement. So I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's something we've been thinking about as well, and it's nice to get outside sort of confirmation that, you know, this seems like a good idea to the to members of the community as well. Regarding your second point, so you know, in this matter, you know, we're litigating under the ADA as well as California's state disability laws, or at least two of them, the UNRU Act and the Disabled Persons Act. And they actually, those statutes require access for service animals, such as guide dogs or signal dogs, or other dogs that are specifically trained to provide a task that is related to somebody's disability, but they don't actually require that public accommodations or transportation services transport pets just generally. So that's sort of one distinction at issue here.
You have another question back here.
Hi, my name is Dane. I actually have like a comment. I was thinking, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had Uber allow us to put on our profile that, hey, we do have a guide dog, and then because, you know, you do have a lot of private drivers and maybe some are allergic to dogs, and if they knew, you know, before they came and got us that, hey, we have a guide dog, then they can choose to decline the ride, and then Uber would, you know, submit it or get another driver for us.
I'm really glad that you raised that point, because it raises a couple issues that we are tackling in the case. So with regards to the first point about self-identification, we have received a lot of mixed feedback from the blind community about that. Some folks have suggested it as a possible way to sort of ensure that blind people with guide dogs don't end up waiting for a driver who shows up only to discriminate. The problem that others have raised with that point is that doesn't seem like a kind of full access solution, which is to say that drivers aren't legally allowed to just opt out of transporting people with guide dogs because, you know, they have, you know, they're afraid of dogs, or they don't like dogs, or they're allergic to dogs, or for any other reason. That actually gets me to, and so our clients actually, in this case, are not, I think at this point, comfortable with kind of a self-report, like a mandatory kind of self-reporting. Although, you know, there could be some sort of optional self-reporting that could end up in a settlement depending on further exploration of kind of different options to fix the problem. Regarding the other point, I just wanted to mention that, or just clarify that, actually an allergy is not considered a valid reason not to transport a person with a guide dog. Neither is a religious objection to dogs as being unclean or some other sort of, you know, religious-based concern about guide dogs. So there isn't any exception like that that's available under the law.
I have another question back here.
Hi, Kelly Hill. I just wanted to say that there is sort of a way that, you know, if some of us, I think, feel in the middle of the road on this issue, we can sort of see why a driver should transport a guide dog, and then others of us can sort of see, like, why someone might not want to support a guide dog. And if you indeed feel that there's, you would like to report to the driver that you have a dog and give them some choice in the matter, then you could attach a picture to your profile and make it a picture of you and your dog. In my case, I have a picture of me with my cane. So I think this helps for two reasons. It would allow you to give that driver a little bit of choice, and it would allow them to identify you when they come to pick you up. So if you indeed feel that way, that's something you could do.
That's a great point. Thanks for that comment. And actually, we've spoken with a number of folks who have chosen to put up pictures with them and their guide dogs, you know, just to make it easier for drivers to identify them and also just to put the drivers on notice. And I understand. I definitely agree that people should be free to self-identify if they desire to.
Mike, quick question. Have you heard from those clients that do put up pictures like that, that they have different experiences than other people, or that they did before they put that picture up?
And actually, I don't know the answer to that question. That is a great question to know. I mean, I guess one concern might be that, you know, it just moves the discriminatory action from the point when the driver comes to pick you up to the point where the driver first sees your request. And you know, that doesn't eliminate the problem, but I can understand that, you know, you out there as a passenger might just want to put a driver on notice early on, even if it means the driver does something you don't want them to do, which is, you know, decide not to accept your request for a ride.
Another question over here.
Well, just a comment based on previous discussion relative to profiling. aside from the fact that it isn't permissible under the ADA, Donna and I know what happens when cab companies profile you as having a guide dog in the days when I had one. The city of Pasadena, the big cab company, we know they profiled us. We know also, based on trips that she made by herself and trips that I made with my dog, that to get a cab took twice as long as when we did not identify or prior to the time they started profiling. It is a dangerous, dangerous precedent, ladies and gentlemen, to self-identify. It is cab companies, Lyft, Uber, they pay attention all over the country to trends here in California. And it is, you know, you hear that proverbial slippery slope. You don't want to take that first step. You really don't.
So I think just to make sure that we are able to address, you know, all of the different cases we were hoping to share with everybody here, I'm going to start discussing the Lyft investigation that we're working on. So I was just telling you about Uber, and Lyft is actually quite similar. So Lyft basically operates the same way. It's a different company. You have a smartphone. You download an app, set up an account. You request a ride through the app. A vehicle comes to pick you up. And if everything goes well, you get in the car and go to whatever destination you give to the driver. Lyft is a smaller company than Uber, but it's available in many areas throughout California and, you know, other places in the U.S. as well. We've received complaints from blind passengers with guide dogs about being denied rides by Lyft drivers as well. We started looking into this issue in greater depth, I'd say, in March of this year. In June, we sent a letter to Lyft on behalf of several blind individuals who had been denied rides by Lyft drivers. And we just recently, well, for the past couple of months, we've been sort of in preliminary conversations. Our letter proposed negotiations, and we've been sort of working out the parameters for those negotiations. Now we've sort of resolved that preliminary issue, and we're actively engaged in discussions with Lyft to address the substance of improving access to Lyft services for blind passengers with guide dogs. We actually also have a press release, a mutually agreed to press release between us and Lyft that sort of provides more information, and we're going to be passing that along to Jean and Jeff, who can share that with the CCB's membership through the weekly newsletter and the other various email channels. And we're going to be publicizing that pretty widely, just so folks know that we are on the problem and working to fix it. So as with Uber, I just wanted to mention to you that, like I said before, we're going to be in the exhibit room later today after this, and we would be interested in speaking with you if you use a guide dog and a Lyft driver has discriminated against you because of your guide dog. And I will open it up, I think, again to some questions. If folks have any questions about the Lyft matter that we didn't already cover with our discussion about Uber, please go ahead and ask them now.
Has anyone here ever used Lyft? Yeah, it is a smaller company, and it's less available than Uber, so that might be one reason that they are more open to speaking with us at an early stage. Uber is very, very litigious by its nature on every issue that you can imagine.
We just checked recently, I'd say in the past few weeks, to see how many cases there are open against Uber. There are 63 cases against Uber open right now.
Yeah.
They are very litigious.
And a lot of them are very high-profile, hard-fought cases. Mike, do you think that the problems with Lyft and Uber are going to result in similar types of remedies, or do you think it's different to each of the companies?
I think that the remedies will be similar. I mean, our goal is to get similar remedies, and I think that although Uber is more litigious, they, I think, have shown more interest recently in settlement talks. I think because they've recognized, now that we've turned over some of our materials to them, that we have a very, very strong case. You know, I mentioned to you that we have over 100 denials that we have documented and recorded, and we continue to hear from blind folks who are being discriminated against by Uber drivers on a weekly basis, if not, you know, more frequently. So I think that the remedies will be similar, even though the companies do have, do have somewhat different kind of postures and backgrounds.
I'm guessing that one other reason that they are more interested in negotiating with us now is because they resoundingly lost on their legal arguments. So that
yes,
that always helps encourage people to talk in a more conciliatory way. Jean?
Yeah, I have a question. It's a little slightly different, but I was wondering if you have heard it, if there's anyone that you know of I never get phone calls. But anyway, do we know if anyone has actually ever, because of a visible disability, Uber or Lyft has maybe not transported them? I know that years ago there was a problem in San Diego when I lived down there a long time ago, and with Yellow Cab, and that there were some drivers, when they knew that it was a blind person, it had nothing to do with the guide dog, they would not transport him. It was cultural things that there was a fear that if a blind person was in their presence or touched them, that they could also possibly become blind, because it was felt that in a different life,
wow,
that you may have done something. And I'm not making any fun of anybody's culture, but this is a true thing. That I ran into in one of my travels out of the country, too.
That is a great question. So actually, I know that other disability legal advocates have been working on ensuring that people who use wheelchairs that are foldable are getting equal access to Uber and Lyft and these other modern taxi-like services. We actually, in our investigation, speaking with the greater disability community about Uber discrimination against blind guide dog users, we've heard from people who use foldable wheelchairs who have had drivers refuse to transport them, sometimes in really terrible circumstances, because the driver didn't want to be bothered with folding up the wheelchair and putting it in the trunk. So yes, we've heard of things like that, but we haven't heard about people refusing to transport people with disabilities just because of their disability in the abstract without any connection to sort of like an inconvenience that the driver perceives.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yep.
Yes. So I'm going to turn it over to Lisa, who is going to take discuss our next matter.
So the next thing we wanted to talk about today was access to movie theaters for people with visual impairments. In particular, AMC, which is a national movie chain with theaters all throughout California, we've been having a number of problems with them. As you probably know, it's required under the ADA to provide auxiliary aids and services to ensure that blind people can enjoy movies at theaters. And AMC, like any other movie theater, is required to make sure that people can access their movies. And that includes providing descriptive narration. Most digital movies these days, if not all digital movies, have digital narration built into them. So it is available. What needs to happen on the theater's end is for the theater to offer descriptive video technology that allows people to actually perceive audibly the narration that's occurring within the movie. And so this type of technology essentially works like this. You go to the movie theater, you ask for audio description, and they hand you a small device that you can hold or clip to your belt, and it plugs into earphones, and you listen to the movie, and there's a narrator that, during pauses in the dialogue of the movie, describes key visual elements that help you understand what is happening in the movie and enjoy the movie. And so AMC has this technology at all of its movie theaters throughout the country, I think, for some movies that don't have this built-in narration, you can't use the technology, but the vast majority of movies, you can use this technology to enjoy the movie. The problem that we're having is that although AMC has these devices at its theaters, a lot of times we're hearing from people that they show up, ask for the device, are assured that the device will work, and then, a couple things happen. Either the staff member can't find the device, or the staff member gives them a device that doesn't function properly, or the staff member doesn't know how to configure the device to make it, play the right movie, or in, the most maybe egregious example, we've had one client where they actually gave them headphones and a device that are for hearing impaired people. So not very helpful. This just displays some sort of fundamental problems, obviously, with the training and the technology. What we've attempted to do is about a year ago, we and our current co-counsel, disability rights advocates, we approached AMC about a year ago, provided some of these examples, told them about their obligations under the law, and requested that they negotiate a solution to the problem with us, in lieu of litigation. And, we were asking for pretty basic things. Some of the things that we want AMC to do to fix the problem is, first and foremost, provide training to their staff about, the nature of disabilities and their obligations under the law to accommodate people. More specifically, we want them to be trained on the audio descriptive devices and how to configure them, You know, which device is appropriate for which disability, how to troubleshoot common problems that might come up with the technology, you know, things like restarting it, and you know, pretty basic things that any normal staff person should be able to accomplish. For more complicated problems, we want them to set up a remote telephone hotline so that there's some person, you know, in a remote location who really understands the ins and outs of the technology. And if it's not something that's pretty easy for the staff member to solve on their own, they can call and get more sort of expert advice on what to do. And then a maintenance protocol to make sure that theaters are actually making sure that these devices exist in appropriate numbers and that they function properly when people try and use them. And finally, what we want is basically just spot checking to make sure that people remember their training, know how to do it if they're called on for these devices, and that, you know, we'll ensure that people can actually use this technology to enjoy the movies at AMC. So we approached AMC about a year ago with some of the stories of our clients, and AMC basically said, well, you know, this is pretty new technology. Technology has glitches. We're planning to do some additional training, but we don't think there's, you know, really a systemic problem. So, needless to say, we are continuing to hear from people at different movie theaters within the AMC chain that they're continuing to have the exact same problems, even after AMC supposedly rolled out its training and it's had plenty of time to work out the glitches in this technology to the extent that's even appropriate, because the technology has existed for many, many years at this point. But we're currently investigating the scope of the problem. We're still hearing about it, and it's happening in a lot of theaters. And so we are considering our next steps, which could include legal action, given the way that AMC, you know, dealt with us the last time around. So we're curious if people have had experiences like this, particularly at AMC, or if, you know, if people have comments on this issue.
Okay. Could we introduce the conversations on the audience, please?
I have not been to an AMC theater because every time I go, and this was a long time ago, of the problem, so I just said, okay, I'm not going to deal with it.
And that's actually something that we're hearing from a lot of people, is that they've tried and they show up and they're, you know, they call in advance, are assured that they will have a device so that they can enjoy the movie. They show up, it doesn't work properly, or the staff member can't find it, or it's playing the wrong movie. And so, you know, they don't waste their time and come back. And that's, you know, that's not acceptable.
Okay, I'm gonna, we have quite a few people here, so just if you guys bear with me, we'll get around to everybody.
And I'm hearing that some people are saying they still cannot hear.
Oh.
And I don't understand. And I was wondering if our technical staff are present, they could see what the problem might be.
I'm certainly willing to speak louder if that helps.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I hope I state this clearly. This is just a comment or a suggestion, or maybe it's already being done. But is AMC posting that they have this accommodation, because there's so many people out there that have visual impairments of all sorts of types that, wow, if they go with their family and it's posted on their theaters, marquees, or, you know, when they purchase their tickets or what have you, a family member can state, oh my God, look what they have. You know, this way it could really be tested, the technology, and AMC can really be pushed, because I think the volume of individuals would increase and they'll see the need that it's real. Because a lot of people, you know, if it's not advertised, they don't know, so they won't ask. Anyway, just a suggestion, or I hope I was clear.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sorry, Lisa.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so AMC does post this information on their website. They also post it on a couple of other sort of movie listing type services, but I'm not 100% sure about this, but I don't think that they have signage at movie theaters, physical signage that talks about it. But They may have that at theaters that we just don't know about. I definitely agree with you, though, that we've heard this point before, which is that, you know, a lot of people in the community actually don't even know that this service is available. It's actually required by law. There's a court case that that held that it's a required service for movie theaters here in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And in fact, the Justice Department, the Federal Justice Department, has already issued draft regulations and is planning to issue permanent regulations that require it as well. So I do agree that, you know, if the service is out there, if it's being required, that there should definitely be more publicity.
And just to be clear, it's not just AMC that should provide this technology and that's required to under the law. Any theater is. So AMC just happens to be the one that we are hearing most specifically about in terms of problems there. But really, any movie theater should be offering this service.
We're getting there, guys, I promise.
A couple of points. It's Mitch. A couple of points to keep in mind if we do head toward litigation. The first one, and again, as a burnt out old trainer, people forget 80% of what they learn within a week if they don't have an opportunity to use it. So what you're dealing with, and we've seen it in the airline industry. Heck, we've seen it with LAPD. Here in this area. So training, not just training, but regular training, perhaps even a monthly refresher.
Yeah.
Because people don't remember if they don't use it. The second part, though, and Michael and I, he's heard this comment with respect to workforce centers around California in another context. The turnover rate in these places, AMC and all the theaters, is outrageous. These folks may not be around for more than a month or two. So it is absolutely critical that the training be frequent and repetitive, and even if somebody has to go through the training four or five times during their stay at an AMC theater as an employee, that's life. Because between those two factors, these kinds of incidences are going to occur and reoccur because folks leave and because folks forget what they learned a week or 2 weeks before.
I think that's absolutely correct, and that's certainly something that we'll be addressing if and when we get to the remedial stage or AMC decides to talk with us. I think one other way to get at that problem is requiring spot checks of employees and doing refresher training if somebody has fallen through the cracks or they forgot what they're supposed to be doing and all of their training. Between sort of those two, we think, plus providing an external expert resource for people that really just can't remember anything, we're hopeful that between those three things that it will improve the situation.
Yeah, so our view on this issue can be boiled down to this, which is, you know, movie theaters seem pretty good at making sure that a variety of different systems that they have work pretty regularly and function pretty regularly. Their popcorn machines seem to work all the time,
cash or most registers, of the time.
The cash registers,
the kiosks,
you know, the movie screens themselves. And so it's definitely logistically doable that they make sure that their audio description equipment work regularly too.
All right, quite a few more questions.
Hi, my name is Christine Bailey. I'm from Riverside, California. I'm the president of the Inland Empire chapter. A comment. I have some friends, they're four guys. Every month, we go to the Regal in the Riverside Plaza. Their staff there is the most wonderful staff you ever know. The guys can call them. They'll take them to the bathrooms. Their headsets, they make sure their headsets are working properly, except for there has one that they need to take out of service. The last time we were at the movies, they were remodeling the theater. The equipment was not working. They actually gave us a free movie ticket to the next movie because the equipment was not working due to construction.
Great. That sounds like the right approach. Here we go.
Okay. Hi, I'm Andy Baracco, and last year when you put out the first inquiry, I was maybe one of the first people who responded. I talked quite a bit with a woman named Haven, I believe it was, and she sent me some paperwork, which I signed, and I never heard anything after that, so I didn't know what was happening with this. I gave quite copious accounts of my experiences with the AMC 16, which actually is right down the street here. But my wife and I are movie buffs. We go out to the movies quite a bit. And in the last year, I think in the two AMC theaters that we go to regularly, I think that there is a greater awareness now. When we go in, they know that we don't want the amplified headset. They know that they know which ones we want and all that. Sometimes the batteries might be dead or something, and you have to bring it back or whatever. But I guess what I want to say is there is another side to this coin, and that is that we need to use the service, you know, because that's the best training that they can have, is to actually have blind people come in there asking for the headsets. We've gotten to know the managers and whatnot at the theaters that we attend quite well, and what they tell us. And I believe it because of the most of the people I know don't go to the movies. They say that hardly any blind people ever come in here. And I think that obviously if they're not, you can do the spot checks with the training and all that, but the best kind of training that you can have is a real world situation where you have somebody coming in asking for the equipment. So I mean, if this is something that we want, you know, we should utilize it. I'm not saying that you should go to a movie that you don't want to see, you know, just to use the equipment. But, you know, if this is something that blind people really want, then they need to avail themselves of it.
It's a bit of a
chicken.
Coming up.
Good morning. William Elliott, Fresno Chapter. I have to say I have no experience of AMC. In Fresno, we're well served with Regal and Meyer Cinemas, and they're very, very progressive. Regal have had the audio description for several years now, and I've found that they're very, very good. The main problems with it is, as has been said, the systems are used so very little. Often the staff haven't had enough practice in being able to actually set up the equipment. And I have been offered several times closed caption glasses as well to allow me to see the text on the screen. But one of the other problems is there's no way to test the system before the movies actually start.
Yeah.
And it would be handy if the staff were able to know what we're experiencing, so then they can find the items that we need. It's basically go to the cinema, the screen, and then come back if there's a problem. By the time you've done that, you've missed the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, it's incredibly disruptive.
Yes.
Yeah, it kind of ruins the entire experience.
All right, I'm getting there.
My name is Marie Brown Palmieri with the San Gabriel Valley CCB. With all the talk about accessibility specialists and that type of thing, has there anything that's come out of the courts or with the law that has required these larger corporations like AMC and Uber and Lyft and whoever else, I'm sure there's a million other areas. Is there any talk about having accessibility specialists? Those might last a little bit longer because they probably will cost the corporations a little bit more money and benefits.
Mike, do you have a comment on
that? Sure. So I think what you're referring to is ADA coordinators. A lot of governmental agencies have ADA coordinators. Like, you know, the city of San Francisco has an ADA coordinator. and you know, the various transportation authorities will often have an ADA coordinator as well. So I am not aware of a case or a court order or any other requirement in the law that has said that a private company needs to offer an ADA coordinator per se to make sure their services to the public and the customers are accessible. But I think that that is certainly one way that a company can do it. And I do believe that there have been settlement agreements where, you know, the parties agreed that one way that a company would make sure their services were accessible would be that they had an accessibility point person or an accessibility team that had the primary purpose of making sure their services were accessible and that people with disabilities were able to, you know, effectively use them and effectively and reliably use the services. So that's certainly within the scope of possibilities, especially in a settlement kind of context.
I think we had a question. Did you have a question, sir? Okay, here you go.
Oh, did I stand up?
There you go.
So if I ask for a do I need to say the specific name of the device when I go to a movie theater? And if I don't get it, if they say that they don't know, do I ask to speak to a manager? Or one of the questions that I'm really asking is, what is the name of the device? So I can know what I'm talking about when I ask for it. So they can know, and if they don't have an answer, the employee, will I ask for a manager or somebody who's been there longer? Or how could I go about that?
Yeah, I think so.
Some of you in the audience probably don't know, but I actually myself am blind, and so I use audio description myself. So when I ask for it, I usually just ask for an audio description, the audio description device or the audio description equipment. The name of the company who makes it is Fidelio. So, you know, if you say the audio description device and folks don't know what you're talking about, you know, one thing you could add when asking for it is mention it's made by Fidelio.
Yeah, one of the confusing things is that people refer to this technology with different descriptions. Some people call it audio description. Some people call it video description. But the particular device that AMC uses is called the Fidelio DVS. Fidelio, Fidelio, DVS. Yeah. We have another question, I think, here.
Probably just one more question.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Here
we go. Go ahead. Hi, Lynn Nishihara from the Greater LA Chapter. My question is, and I apologize if it's something that everybody already knows, is at what point is the audio description created? In other words, is it done by the theater itself, or is it from the film producer? Because I know that movies now are all digital.
Yeah.
So in that regard, is it possible that one day we can have technology that it comes directly to us, maybe on a channel or something, so you can take out the middleman? And we can just have it, you know, to turn it on if available. But I don't know if that's possible or not.
That's a really good idea. It is not the theater that provides the description. I assume it's the movie producing company itself. Yeah, it's embedded within the digital technology. So all the movie theater has to do is provide you the device to access it. So I think your point is very well taken, that it makes a whole lot of sense for you to just be able to tune in yourself on your own device. I'm not sure where the technology is with that right now. But certainly that would be a really smart solution to this problem, because as we've discussed, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg problem here, which is that, you know, there's huge amounts of staff turnover. People are not well trained. They don't remember the technology because people don't use it that frequently. But then when people go to use it, they're discouraged from ever trying to come back because they show up, they spend their money, they take their time, and then it doesn't work, and it's incredibly frustrating. So then they never want to come back. So there's this, you know, chicken and egg problem with getting people staff at the theater is more familiar with this, which in turn will encourage more people to use it. But I think you're right that allowing people to use just their own personal device in some way that cuts out the middleman would be a really great solution. I don't know where the technology is with that, though.
We need an app.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just wanted to add one point on, you mentioned, you know, audio description through television. Just so you know, so Netflix does offer audio description for a number of movies, as well as most of their original series. And there are regulations that actually require that certain television networks provide a certain amount of audio description for programs on a quarterly basis. I think it's 50 hours a quarter are required, but that requirement only applies to certain television networks. And I don't remember the specifics right now.
We have a couple more questions, Gene, or is time?
Absolutely. One last question, then I'm going to make a comment. Is there one?
Okay, who has the most important question?
Suddenly, no one's raising their hand.
Anybody have a question, or did I misspeak? Oh, okay, we have one more. Sorry.
Thank you. I was wondering how far the things have gotten on TV, because I've been hearing that networks are supposed to have so many hours, but I have yet to hear anything on video descriptive. Also, I know I have read that Britain has the technology for talking boxes, so that the remote, when you push, will say what you're doing, you know, like the microwave timers, etc. But that's not, every time we bring it up to the people, you know, with Fios or Direct or any of the other, they've never heard anything about it. But if the technology is already out there and legislation was signed, I believe, in August of 2010, why nothing's happening? Thank you.
Sure. So that's a little.
Sorry. My name's Jan. I'm from Claremont.
Okay. So that's a little outside the scope of the audio description that we're working on. To answer your question, so as far as I know, only Comcast offers a talking cable box. That's the only company in the United States, and I really don't have information on the sort of status of audio description for various television networks.
Yeah, and I would say that probably there are going to be other legal groups that will probably be looking into this whole issue. You know, Comcast, you know, does have a staff dedicated to providing the audio description, the accessibility equipment things, and I can tell you the other cable companies and also satellite don't seem to have it. AT&T, you call and ask, how do you get audio description on your cable? And the technicians and the people there don't know what you're talking about, don't have any idea. So I got an idea that there's going to be some suits there. So hold those concerns and thoughts. But AMC Theater is the number one thing right now. And we're behind, and I would like to thank us to give a hand to Lisa and Mike for their presentation.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you. As Mike mentioned earlier, we're going to be sitting in the exhibitors room hall. So if you'd like to come speak with us, or if you'd like to call us or email us at a later time, Gene has our information, and I think it's in the attachments that you've received as well. So we'd love to speak with you if you have anything that you'd like to share with us about these matters. And thanks again for the opportunity.
Yes, thanks everybody. I'm happy to be back at a CCB convention. Appreciate the opportunity to share. We would love to hear from you, whether it's, you know, here at the convention or by phone or by email in the future. So thanks again.
And they're also going to be talking this afternoon during the general section about absentee voting. So that is something you definitely want to hear this afternoon, and that's something, and they also be able to talk to you in the exhibit room at their table. So thank you. Thank you very much. We are going to enter the area of access to the supportive environment, particularly with persons with low vision. The National Institute for Building Sciences has recently released a guideline on how to create supportive environments for people with low vision in buildings, like do with lighting, the orientation of windows, and so forth. And the organization's low vision design committee is now working on developing a national standard. The American Council of the Blind Environmental Access Committee was asked to provide input early in 2014, which we did, and some of those concepts did get into the guide. We're very fortunate that our next speaker, Mr. Henry Green, who is the president of the National Institute of Building Sciences, was out here and was able to come and is with us today to talk about what is the National Institute of Building Sciences, to talk about the guideline, and why there's a need for a national standard. He also will be getting into the discussion of what those environmental aspects that designers are addressing or should be addressing when building a facility that, from the perspective of persons with low vision. And I think you will have an opportunity this time and probably down the road, and as draft documents will be issued, to provide input for those of you who do have the low vision and are affected by how buildings are constructed. So let's give Mr. Green a big hand.
Well, good morning. I trust everyone is having a good day today. Let me tell you just a little bit about the National Institute of Building Sciences so you know what we do and why we engage in this business. The Institute was actually founded in 1974 by Congress. And our role is to be an interface between the government and private sector organizations to actually find solutions to issues that face the built environment or people within the built environment. Our position is one that we are not a government agency. We're a private 501c3 corporation that facilitates this kind of research and investigation and then help to write standards, guidance documents, and facilitate making our built environment more accessible and better for everyone. We study issues from seismic activities, which are prevalent out here in California, to water problems with regard to flooding, high wind events, as we're now going to experience on the East Coast because of the hurricane heading up the East Coast now. We also talk about building enclosures, indoor air quality, lighting, everything that has to do with the built environment. So we do that through volunteer researchers that do work for us, and we actually develop documents that can facilitate the application of these things that we find. We have a very simple mission, quite frankly, and that is to serve the nation and the public interest by supporting advances in building science and technology to improve the built environment. And about 2 years ago, actually in 2010, we actually helped set up a workshop on low vision. And this workshop was actually funded by the General Services Administration. And that workshop was created by a person within GSA who is an engineer who is losing his vision to retinal pigmentosa. He had very, very limited vision. He was actually doing some building evaluations, and as he was doing that, he found himself in a position of unable to do his work because of many of the issues he faced by going into buildings where he encountered many obstacles in the wayfinding, within the lighting within the building, glare, shadows, and the like. So that brought together architects, engineers, lighting engineers, interior designers, ophthalmologists, opticians, government employees, and they found that they had a lot to teach and learn from one another in that whole session. So that report was issued in 2011, and it is a report that we rely on, actually we relied on, to create the Low Vision Design Committee, which went into effect in November 2011. And their purpose was to address the needs of occupants of the built environment, including those with low vision, through improvements in design and operational procedures for new and existing facilities to enhance the functionality, safety, and quality of life. And they were also to identify existing knowledge and needs to further research to accomplish those objectives. So as we started that work, we found that we had to bring together a different group of professionals to actually sit down and work on this project. The Low Vision Committee has a great representation. It includes people who actually represent organizations that represent low vision. People with low vision, we have ophthalmologists, we have scientists, we have educators, we have architects and engineers, all whom came together to help develop the standard. Their main project, though, was to develop a design standard for health and safety in the visual environment through three steps. A guideline, which went through six revisions and then two public hearing periods before it was actually published in 2015. A guideline which we hope to turn into a standard, which we're working on today. And we're talking right now, and one of the reasons I was out in California this week was talk to the International Code Council, because they're having their actual conference out here in Long Beach this week to develop it into a standard. And then to get it adopted within the body of codes, so that we would have within the body of codes provisions that deal with wayfinding as well as a low vision issues within a building. So I see you're going to have in the next session you're going to have a doctor come in and talk to you about low vision and some things that are going on with regard to information flow. But I also wanted to tell you why we did this. Low vision, as we've defined it, is vision that can't be corrected to a 20/70 or better proposition. That can't be improved with standard glasses or contact lenses, that can't be corrected by surgery or medicines. And according to the National Eye Institute and the National Institutes of Health, low vision affects 17 million Americans. Low vision increases in prevalence with the age of the population, making it an increasingly important design concern as the general population of this country ages. Here's another issue. The American Disabilities Act right now deals with blindness, not low vision. So what's wrong, or what goes wrong with our vision? And you probably are very familiar with this, and you're going to hear more about it. They're the cataracts, which prevent light from reaching the retina or light receptor of the eyes. It causes fuzzy view of the world. Monocular degeneration and age-related macular occurs in 33% of the people over 75. Causes of loss of central vision, while peripheral vision is intact. Retinopathy causes multiple blind spots. Diabetic retinopathy is on the rise, and the incidence of diabetes increases. Retinal pigmentosa falls into this kind of category, Glaucoma, in which it damages the optic nerve fibers, blocking signals to the brain. And there's also low vision caused by brain damage, caused by strokes or traumatic brain injuries, leading to damage to the brain tissue that processes information that it gets from the eyes. So why do we need to do this? We need to take a look at the architectural provisions within our buildings so that we can address these issues. It includes things such as basic lighting concepts, where we want to minimize glare. We want to talk about light surfaces. We want to use lights or layers of light, ambient and overall light, surface lighting, task lighting, controls, controls and more controls. Different types of low vision may be helped by different kinds and intensities of lighting. The more adjustable, the better it'll work. The Low Vision Design Committee believed that the NFPA standard for emergency egress lighting, corridors and stairs is inadequate for those with low vision. What about wayfinding? Exterior walking surfaces, avoiding confusing patterns, being aware of intensity of sunlight compared to nighttime. Walking surfaces should be of a medium to dark in value. We want to clearly define walkway obstacles or obstructions. People with low vision may not detect planters, for example. Few people with low vision use long canes. Clearly define changes in levels in buildings, for example, using a contrast strip on the edge of a stair nosing. Define curbs, ramps, and steps. Contrast is needed where ramps and curbs to avoid tripping hazards. Avoid tapered stairs and add a handrail at the location. Avoid pattern on stairs. Make lighting consistent on each tread. Use high contrast features and accent lighting to highlight destinations. We want to work on surfaces. Avoid reflective or transparent vertical surfaces. Transparent panels lack definitions. They create hazards. Vertical mirrors at entryways create optical illusions leading to accidents. And that's not just for folks who have low visual acuity. We have people who actually walk into windows adjacent to doors. And the code has gone in, for example, and made sure that there are markings on windows adjacent to doors so people don't walk through them. And we've also gone in into the codes, the standards, to make sure that the glass that they're using is not glass that actually just will cut people, but actually powders, if you will, so that if you do walk into it, it will not cause a hazard. But we also want to provide adequate transition zones within buildings. Eyes for those with low vision adapt more slowly to contrast. So when you're coming from a bright light outside into a building, you have to have a transition area so that your eyes can adjust to those areas. It also works when you go back outside as well, going from a low light area to a bright light area. And we need to take those kind of staging areas into consideration when we're designing buildings. We want to avoid glare. Reflective glare on polished surfaces can be troubling to persons, even sighted persons. And so it can create a different kind of problem for people with low visual acuity. Disability glare distorts the pathway. And we're in this hotel, and this is one of the things that I found real intriguing, because at our last conference, we had the Washington Area Council for the Blind actually come in, and they brought in the goggles, the glasses that you can use that simulate different conditions. Well, it's real interesting when you put those goggles on, and for example, I used a pair and I got to the escalator, and the escalator looked just like a slide. If you walk in a hotel, you look at the crazy carpet that they have on the floors sometimes, which can cause depth perception issues. And actually, we had people who tripped on the carpet because of the pattern of the carpet. So all those kinds of things have to be taken into consideration as we're working. Make the circulation lighting consistent. If you'll recall, if you look down some corridors in hotels, for example, you'll see they have spotlighting in the corridors, which make dark and bright spots in the corridors. So we need to do better work in terms of the level of lighting or making it more consistent within the building. We also have to address signage. Increase signage contrast between the letters in the field as well as between the sign and the wall itself. And then we need to use good contrast to repeat information at eye level. And light from the side or internally to avoid shadows. So finally, all these things that we're trying to do are done so that we can, in fact, improve the wayfinding with buildings, can design better to provide for the 17 million Americans that actually are facing these kinds of issues as they go forward with regard to their lifestyles. And here's one of the things that I always say. The older you get, your eyes are always going to get badder. There's no doubt about it. So we really want to make this work. We want this to be the kind of provisions that we put into codes and standards that will improve. Much like when we saw the ADA come about and there were provisions that were put into the ADA with respect to issues to assist people who are blind, also people who have mobility impairments. We also want to address these issues with regard to people who have low visual acuity. And so from that standpoint, we really tried to pull this together. But we also have to provide a great thank you to people that helped us get there to do this, and that is the Hilda B. and Maurice L. Rothschild Foundation, the Jim H. McClung Lighting Research Foundation, also the General Services Administration, which actually initially funded this activity. So if you want more information relative to what we're doing with the guidelines, you can go to our website, which is www.nibs.org, and you can get information there. We also have a staff person available that you can reach out to, and you can contact Stephanie Stubbs at 202-289-7800, or you can get her in her email address as sstubbs, S-S-T-U-B-B-S, at nibs.org. Be happy to answer any of your questions that you might have relative to what we're doing with the standard, how we got there, and where we're going to go from here.
I'm going to take the liberty of just asking some, make some comments, and then let the audience. You were sharing with us about on the edge of steps and drop-offs having a contrasting stripe, and that's something that on the national and state level, that's something the organizations, the council have supportive, mm-hmm. and contrast is the first thing. There are people, not all persons with low vision because of their different loss of vision, that find that there is the yellow-orange color that really helps enhance the contrast,
mm-hmm.
and we. That, of course, aesthetically is not an attractive color in the design of a building. We're getting resistance on that even just with exterior steps. So I'm just wondering if your institute has done any work, one, in showing the need for the contrasting striping, not just exterior on every tread, but also the interior. I don't know how familiar with the California Building Code. It was 1982, the late Dr. Samuel Janeski mm-hmm. got that in the code, but a lot of people with low vision have problems with just having interior steps, having the upper tread in the upper approach in the last tread at the bottom of the steps with the stripe where the steps look like a ramp to them or just like correct. The escalators there.
Mm-hmm.
And designers do not seem to grasp it. And even the regulatory people, our Division of State Architects Office, they're very sensitive, but that is something they, like, because maybe the politics, that is one thing. And the contrast we're talking about, you might be quite familiar with the work of Sharon Toji, Access Communications, has been trying with ANSI for years to get a corrected contrast formula, and I guess there's a lot of work that's come out of the UK that has found that the formula that originally was given to us by the U.S. Access Board back in the 70s is flawed. But there's so much resistance, even with the signage industry, on having a good contrast formula that's measurable. And I'm just wondering if your institute has jumped into some of these areas and has documents that could help us then push for these changes. That's a lot, I know.
I'm not an expert, okay? I run the company, so. But I will tell you this, and I've gotten engaged in this whole development with our low vision committee because it's something that I see as really important to our nation and to the public. First of all, let me give you a little bit of background so that you understand my history and what I did to get where I'm at today. And it's relevant because you'll understand why I have such, I think, a passion for this. In mid-career, in my quest to get where I'm at today, I was actually the director of the Barrier-Free Design Division for the state of Michigan, which is the accessibility program in Michigan. So I've worked in this area for a number of years. I also served as the president of the International Code Council, which writes the ANSI A117. They're the secretariat to ANSI A117. So I have a very good, strong passion for the kind of work that you're doing. Now, with that said, one of the things that we looked at the Low Vision Committee was color and contrast. And there are, within the guidelines that we have, it is more than just a guideline. It also goes into the research of what color and contrast means. It talks about how colors, contrast can actually assist in terms of wayfinding within buildings, alerts on terms of sharp edges or edges where stairs occur or the kind of thing. So as we're moving forward, and all this is contained within the body of the guideline, as we move forward and we move this to a standard, that's where we need to make sure that it is built into the standards. And we'll take those strong looks at what is the appropriate level of color and contrast to identify or to differentiate levels within buildings or on stairs. And not just the leading stair, but also all the stairs. The other thing that we have to take a look at is what are the tread riser requirements within codes. And that plays a real important part because if you have a shallow stair tread, it makes navigation of the stairs difficult. If you have a high riser within a stair, it makes it difficult. So having the right ratio in terms of tread riser formulation, as well as contrasting colors or identification of the leading edge of the stair, really makes a difference. And one of the things that is built in here is that there has to be contrast between the riser and the tread, so that you can differentiate where treads are versus risers, so it doesn't look like a slidescape. So all those kind of things are built into the standard or into the guideline. It is now our responsibility to move this forward and write it into mandatory language. With respect to the application of these standards across the country, if we get it built into a standard that's referenced in the ADA or within the international codes, it makes it more applicable in many communities because they do rely on those codes. The California code, for example, is based in large part on what's in the international codes as well as the ADA requirements. California has taken the lead in a lot of places with respect to development of accessibility standards, and they've influenced what's gone on with respect to the ADA itself. And so all this work is being coordinated so that we make sure that we have the right requirements within the body of the standard that we're developing. So we'll address many of the issues that you've just raised.
Okay, good. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, Charlene Ornelas from San Diego. I do a lot of work done in San Diego on accessibility and in an advisory position on several committees. One of the issues that I'm wanting to know if you've addressed is at what point does audio need to coincide with visual indications like on signs? Because there are new things like NextBus, detours, whatever, that are coming out as a digital for sighted people. I keep trying to tell them that, you know, I'd like to know when that there's a delay on my bus or my bus stop has been discontinued, but I don't have access to that. And are you doing any work to try to get to define what is the pertinent information?
Well, I think what you're going to find is your next speaker will be able to address that a little bit more because he's talking in his section about the groundbreaking work on GPS systems. So when people are actually walking through buildings and or in public spaces, they'll have verbal indicators that would help them navigate within those spaces. The low vision committee was dealing more with the aspect of how we can deal with color contrast, glare, and lighting within buildings. We also have talked about, for example, are there needs, and that's something that has to be coordinated within the ADA requirements for the verbal warnings or indicators that would go into buildings. So we've taken one small piece of it and tried to address that. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't go in and talk about the additional requirements for verbal or audio warnings or indicators that can go in there. So we'll take a look at that as we move forward. Okay, hold on. She's got a microphone, okay? Go ahead, sir.
William Elliott, Fresno chapter. Earlier you mentioned about darkening, was it sidewalks, external to buildings, in your speech?
Are you talking about sidewalks inside or outside?
We're talking about sidewalks inside and outside of buildings.
You mentioned in using contrast and darkening sidewalks. I wonder, as a guide dog user in the Central Valley and in other areas of the United States, air temperatures can reach the triple digits, often 110. That is dangerous for guide dogs, their paws. A dark sidewalk would actually raise the temperature enough to damage the dog's paws. So I wonder how mandatory would that be? Would various areas have the ability to change the regulation to make reflective light sidewalks instead?
And I apologize, I'm making a note, okay? It's a good point that you raised. I don't know as if we've talked about dark sidewalks per se, but what we talked about are color contrast, for example, when you get to curbs, ramps, slopes and sidewalks, so that there's a distinguishing pattern or way for people with low visual acuity to understand that there is a differentiation in elevation. And that's what we want to focus on. So I will take back the information that you just provided, and I think it's a good point that we would include in our body of knowledge, okay?
What President Green is also touching on, too, is, and I think, is that it's not requiring dark sidewalks. It's where it's light on dark or dark on light, so that perhaps where you have a community that might decide to use red brick for the sidewalk topping, but you get to a curb ramp, and that'd be a contrasting a light concrete, so mm-hmm. that would stand out with the detectable warning on the lower end there, or if the sidewalk is adjacent to, you know, an asphalt parking lot pavement there, so the contrast, so that it would not be strictly dark, and the concern is very much legit. With the burning paws and people's walking on surfaces that could be 100 plus degrees. You're absolutely right, but it's light on dark or dark on light.
Correct.
Next question.
Couple things. First, just a bit of advice. When you're talking about low vision, it's kind of best to talk about the functional part of the disability, because the medical disabilities can just be all over the place. But, you know, for example, with respect to reading, people with central retina damage have pretty much the same reading problems across the spectrum. People with peripheral have similar problems. You have blurry and hazy vision, and then you'll have light sensitivity. Within those categories, generally, people tend to have similar problems. Is there a written comment period?
The written comment period on the guidance document is completed. It's published now. It went out for two. When we go to the standards development process, absolutely there will be public comment periods.
Okay, and it's on a website?
The guidance document is on the public website. It's on our site right now, www.nibs.org, and just look for Low Vision Committee. And you click on there, and then you'll see the document itself on there. And you can click on the document. It's a free document, downloadable.
Okay, and it's not just in PDF, because, you know, they didn't really get the guidelines right for low vision.
Okay.
On that, so if we could have HTML, it would be nice.
Okay. And by the way, I actually had my office. I saw that you're actually webcasting the sound off of this, so I sent them an email and told them to tune in today, so they're getting all the notes too while we're talking today.
Hi, this is Debbie Cordero. I just wanted something. I just wanted just to share something, just an experience. I just wanted to applaud everything that you're doing. I guess nationally, I just wanted to share a quick experience going through Union Station here in LA, and navigating from one end of the building to the front was pleasant, because I remember way back in the day it was not. Getting off the bus, off Metro, you know, from the curb, there was a natural path. You know, I would look up and I'm thinking, okay, I see nothing but glass. Where's the door? And on my feet, I could feel a rubber path of some type, some kind of carpeting. I forgot what it was. So naturally, I followed that path instead of looking which window was the door, you know. And once I got in the building, I experienced what you said. Coming from the light, that entrance was still lit to kind of blend in with where I was coming in. And going down into the escalators underground, again, it was a gradual change in the lighting. So I just wanted just to applaud everything that you're doing and fighting for us. So that's all. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You bring up a real interesting point. If there was an article probably 2 or 3 months ago that was in the Washington Post regarding the metro system in Washington, D.C., and the difficulties of, because it's much of it is underground, going from daylight down the escalators that get down into the metro railways, and there are some significant lighting problems. And there's a whole group of folks in Washington, D.C. that are working on that issue with regard to that. So as we try and write these standards, we're learning those lessons to make sure that we're able to include that kind of information within the body of knowledge that we can to support changes in how we do wayfinding, how we do lighting, how we deal with color contrast, bright spots, glare, all those things that we're learning, we actually put it into the catalog of information. Once you get into the guidelines, that you'll see that there is a significant bibliography that includes a lot of information that goes into great detail about these issues. And we're using that to help bolster the idea that we can improve our built environment by making sure that we do care for these issues as we go forward. So thank you. I like that, by the way.
Hello, my name is Christine Bailey. I'm from California Council for the Blind, the Inland Empire chapter. I live in Riverside, and we have an issue. I don't know if it's regarding you or anybody else, but we're trying to fix it out. We have railroads that are now being lifted up into the sky, and we have sidewalks that are like 30 to 40 feet up in the air and with slopes. And there is, if somebody was totally blind, they could fall off the slope into the upcoming traffic on mm-hmm. the streets. And with scooters and mopeds and all the stuff that's on the sidewalks, it's becoming a very dangerous issue. We went to this council, they just said it's ADA applicable, and that's all they can do about it.
Hmm. That's not one area that's necessarily in my bailiwick, okay? I understand the concern that you have. I would think that if you take a look at some of the transportation standards, they're going to tell you that there's got to be barriers to keep to address people who might fall, particularly with regard to bridges. I think there are some requirements within those standards that protect pedestrian traffic on bridges.
The railings.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that again, you might want to check with folks that deal with the highways and streets to see if they have any standards in place.
I've often thought that the rainbow, I'm sorry, Karen Memmer from the San Fernando Valley chapter, that the colors of the rainbow can be used as symbols for numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The rainbow doesn't change, so we can have the beginning color being one, and that could be used as to indicate what floor number you're on when you're in a building like this,
mm-hmm.
or on the buttons of the elevator. And growing up, if we can associate the number with the color, it make things much easier for us who don't see numbers but see the colors. Then I've often wondered why in the restrooms these days they're still using those blue signages with the symbol of a man or a woman. Well, I can't see the man, I can't see the woman. I still have to walk up to it. Why can't they just give me a different color? Why are they both blue?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question, but that's one of the issues with regard to accessibility, that there was some standardization in terms of signage, so that it would be somewhat universal in terms of the colors that they're using. Here's the other issue that we have to consider with respect to using color, and that is that there are people who are colorblind.
Yes.
So I think there was, more importantly, it's the contrast, the illumination. Backlit buttons, for example, are very difficult, I think, at certain times to see unless there is distinguishable contrast between the backlighting and the symbol that's on whatever it is being backlit. So those are the kind of things that I think this low vision committee wanted to take into consideration. So again, all these things that we're talking about today, we'll put those into the catalog of information so that we can take a look at that. This low vision committee, I think, is going to come back together because I think they have, as a result of our presenting this this concept over and over, we're getting more and more information that we can actually build into the document. So thank you.
Oh, another thing. North, west, and south, four different directions. Please give us four distinct colors. Then I don't have to read it. I can just... Oh, that.
Regarding why the access signs, the ISAs are white on blue, that was a color that was put into the code going back into 82, and it was from the people with mobility limitations that came up with that blue. So the universally, with the idea of blue, like the blue curb for disabled parking and so forth, that's the reason in the code there. But as President Green pointed out, because of people's different vision problems, not everyone can, or color blindness, see some of those colors truly as they are. So that's color coding, you know, it can be useful, but you still have to have it with the others aspects of it. But to change the codes, we're just finishing the 2000 cycle in California. And so in 3 years, there'll be another code cycle. So if there's some proposed language that you'd like to see in there with use of colors for identifying objects, information, we'd be happy to work with you and get that into the Division of State Architect's office to be considered. So not saying the door is closed and shouldn't be considered what you're suggesting. Other questions? Don't forget... Two, you got the geometric shapes in California, the circle for women,
yay,
triangle for men.
And woo-hoo!
Well,
I love them.
You know, tactually discernible, and they're 12 inches in diameter.
Gene, you jumped into my head because
yes.
This is Donna
Palmer. Contrast
and,
requirement.
In from Pasadena. The geometric shapes are wonderful. You also... have people who speak different languages, but, you know, they know the shapes and they aren't able to read the words. I wish that was something that we could get into the standards on a national level. Don't want to lose my triangles and circles. I know that's a little thing, but extremely important. I will also state that a battle that we seem to be dealing with is, and you spoke about it briefly in the beginning, the concern regarding lighting. Different entities are wanting to go to this more artistic kind of mood lighting things, whether it's in stations, whether, you know, in different environments. And a lot of that, quote unquote, mood or artistic lighting doesn't work very well for a number of us with low vision. So, you know, please, you know, keep those lighting issues to the forefront as well. In closing, I would like to say that I'm happy that you're interfacing with the folks in you mentioned Washington, D.C. That's our affiliate, the equivalent of California Council of Citizens with Low Vision here in California. You're mm-hmm. working with some of our Washington group people, and I'm happy to hear that you're doing that. Thank you.
More than welcome. That's actually the National Capital Citizens with Low Vision. So, and they were on our committee.
This is Debbie again. I just had something quickly. It was kind of funny. The lady up front that talked about the rainbow colors, and Donna over here, I don't want to say she stole, but she touched on what I was going to share that was kind of funny, and that was the circles and
Debbie,
the triangles.
Give some feedback. Mike,
hello? Hello?
He's got it cranked up a bit. Yeah, I think you need to turn the mics, the speakers down just a little bit.
Okay, do you hear feedback still?
Go on, Debbie.
Okay,
now.
Can you hear me? Okay. Just a little funny thing regarding the circles and the triangles. I don't know if it's something that's standard that has to go on certain buildings, but you know, obviously the triangle is supposed to be the guy, the circle is supposed to be the girl, and I kind of take offense that the circle is the girl. But anyway, but that's not where I'm going. But I went into this building in Koreatown over here on Wilshire and Normandy in LA, and I look for those circles sometimes if the lighting is not right, and I walk into the men's restroom. And there was a guy in there, and I just said, "What are you doing here?" And I noticed there were urinals, and I thought, "Am I in the wrong place?" And I looked at the door, and I said, "There's a circle here. That's supposed to be the win." So anyway, I shared to him, and he turned around. Obviously, I couldn't see what was going on there. I'm trying to tell my story to him while he's doing what he's doing. And I said, "Excuse me, I'll walk out." But, you know, I had to share with the building because I went to the other floors. And the whole building was wrong. The whole building was wrong. And I shared with them, "You need to go next door and go check out the building next door, and you could see what I'm talking about for people like me." Anyway, I don't know who the inspector was, but anyway.
I don't have any comment for that one. Understand.
Any other questions?
Yes. William Elliott from Fresno again. I would just like to say I would like to see possibly bathroom designers being allowed to use some color. Often I walk into a bathroom, it's brightly lit, white tile floor, white tile walls, white hand dryer against a white wall, white toilets, light-colored cubicle doors. I'd just like to see maybe, you know, designers could use colors to outline where the floor ends. They can still use white floors, mark hand dry positions for hand dryers with different colored tiles, wash hand basins, urinals with some contrasting colors. That would be nice, please.
Absolutely. One of the things that, if you look into the guidelines, it talks about fixture contrast in restrooms. And you use as an example sinks. If you go in, that's the easiest one to use in all audiences, is to talk about the sinks, okay? But when you have a white counter and then you have a white sink, it's hard to distinguish where the sink is. And so just having color contrast between the sink and the countertop makes it easier for people to navigate within the restroom. So we do have within the body of the standard differentiations for with regard to floor to wall contrast color. Doors, for example, if you look at doors down a corridor, if they're the same color as the corridor, it's difficult to distinguish where the door is. So we've talked about that. So there are a number of things that are in there that help with wayfinding with regard to what's going on. It also talks about placement of furniture in access pathways. So we've tried to build all those things within the guidance documents. The guidance document is more for an architect to take a look at when they're designing a building to make sure that they have considered many things that may not be in our codes and standards today, to give them guidance on design. Once we start putting things into the code or into a standard, they will become mandatory issues. And so in the interim, what we want to do is give designers and builders, owners of buildings, information with regard to guidance. And just as a point to show how far we're going in terms of trying to make sure that we get this information out as a guidance document, we're actually going to different organizations and talking about this guidance. We've made a presentation at the American Institute of Architects annual meeting on this issue with regard to wayfinding and low vision. We're actually proposing to the Building Owners Managers Association, BOMA, which is the organization of all the building owners in the country, to give a presentation to their members so that they would become aware of some of the issues with regard to wayfinding and people with low vision. So we're trying to get the information out in the interim as we move forward with the development of a standard.
Hi, Lynn Ishihara here from the Greater LA chapter again. I really appreciate the guidelines that you have, and I hope that they do become standards. And from what it sounds, it's primarily for new buildings or maybe buildings that are being redone. Do you have suggestions for people or companies that have existing buildings on how they can try and do your suggestions without tearing the building down? Mainly because people, they don't have enough money maybe, or is there anything that's relatively low cost that they can do in the interim to meet your guidelines? And also in classes, are architects and designers, are they given references so that they can teach people, the up-and-coming architects and designers and whoever else is involved, on what the guidelines are so that they can think about it and build it and suggest it to their clients?
First of all, with regard to existing buildings, the guideline that we've developed is not simply applicable to new construction. It can apply to any building, existing and or new, because we're talking about, in some cases, lighting changes, fixing things so we don't have glare contrast within buildings, transitional areas within buildings, and that can be done with lighting. We're talking about color contrast, which is painting essentially, which is relatively low cost. So there are a lot of things that you can do in an existing building to achieve many of the things that the guidelines would set forward. With regard to what's being taught in colleges and universities, that's a whole nother subject with regard to post-secondary education in terms of the architectural and engineering profession. We actually have a program that we're conducting in January about building science in North America. And it's not just the issues that we've talked about today, but the science of building is not being taught in colleges and universities today, particularly architectural programs. It is about architecture. There's a lot of things that go into the design of buildings that are science-based. The National Institute of Building Sciences believe that that in terms of achieving high-performance buildings, and when I talk about high-performance buildings, it's not just from an energy perspective. It is for productivity. It is for lifestyle. It is for accessibility. It is all those things that are wrapped into one to make a building, the built environment, more conducive to us, people that use it. We spend over 80% of our time in buildings. That's the reality. And so why shouldn't that environment be built so that when we're spending 80% of our lives indoors, that in fact we are in an environment that is that facilitates our being? And so we want to teach that science. And so when we're going to this program in January and talk about building science in North America, one of the things that we will advocate for is that colleges and universities include the science in their curricula, so that the architects and engineers that are coming out will have an understanding of what is behind it. For example, if you take a look at this guidance document, there's a lot of science behind it. And that gives designers the acumen, if you will, to understand why they need to do certain things, not just because the code or the standard says it, but what does it achieve? Who does it impact? And what outcome can they expect? So those are the kind of things that we want to see within this profession.
Good morning. Kathy Schmidt-Whitaker from from Diamond Bar. And I have one comment and a question. Just from what you were talking about with universities and colleges, one of the avenues may be also looking at the accrediting bodies for architecture and engineering curriculum through the accrediting associations. That might be one avenue. My question was in regards to the title of the 2015 guidance documents. What is that title and where could we access it?
The title of the document that I've been referencing is called Design Guidelines for the Visual Environment. And it is out. It is on our website currently. And it has a May 2015 publication date. In response to the other comment with regard to the accrediting bodies for architects and engineers, here's the problem that we have. There are 50 different accrediting bodies. Each state has their own accrediting credentialing programs. NCARB, the National Accreditation, I can't remember what all of it stands for, but they're representative of all of the 50 states. The reason we chose to go to academia is because we actually can get to department heads within the colleges and universities and make a stronger transition in terms of the understanding. Certainly we'd like to see the knowledge that individuals have and that are tested on, certainly, or credentialed on, would have this into that. But we believe that probably the best place to get the biggest bang for the buck is to go to the colleges and universities. Here's the other problem with that. When you go to colleges and universities and try and change curricula, it is department heads, and it takes an act of God to change curricula at schools. And we're finding that. But one of the things that we're seeing more importantly is that with this building science in North America discussion that we're going to have, we have a number of department heads that are coming to the program that we can influence their thinking. And so we want to make, and this is relatively new, but we want to influence their thinking so that we can actually achieve the goal of having more information included within the curricula on colleges and universities.
We can entertain just one more question. We're over, way over, but...
Okay, hi, my name is Tanya. I'm from the Yosemite Gateway chapter. It's kind of a comment kind of question, and it's in regard to the design and contrast. We have a couple stores there in Merced, Hobby Lobby and a Target and a grocery store, who have moved into existing buildings that have poles or columns. And I think we have at least four members who have run into the polls. We have petitioned them. We asked Hobby Lobby, you're a craft store. You have all this decorating. Can you not decorate your polls so there's contrast? I have run into it twice myself because it's like the cream color and yes. Then the lighting causes a glare and the floor is the same color and the ceiling is the same color. And it's not blocked by shelves. and we've asked them without help, both all three stores, about just putting a stripe, maybe like a barbershop paint, you know, nothing extravagant, nothing expensive, a ribbon, something, so that the low vision people aren't running into their poles. If there's anything you can give us to help us get them to maybe see our way of seeing without us having a catastrophe where litigation is going to become involved because someone has fallen and their answer was, you should have been watching where you're going. And they haven't moved on their stance in over a year.
Here's the problem that you're facing. They don't have a knowledge base to make a discerned decision. And when I say that, they had an architect or an engineer who came in and said, here's what you ought to do. They've defined their color patterns within their store because that's their marketing strategy. Take them a copy of the guideline and give it to them and say, you might want to take a look at this because it'll give you guidance in terms of what you do in terms of wayfinding within your building for people with low visual acuity. And that's what it was done. It was written for, is to give guidance. It's not telling them they have to do it, but it is best practice, okay? And they may take that to heart, but it is not you just walking in and saying that this is an issue. Here's a document that's been developed on a national scale that talks about what these issues are. Okay?
Thank you. Just in closing, and with your notes, several years ago, the California State Fire Marshal's Office had a task force, which I was representing the council, but there were people with low vision on it. And the one thing that was concerned was having some standardization, a contrasting surface, a color, something for exit doors like stairways, mm-hmm. so that people could, in case of fire, and they were suggesting either putting the door jamb, having a
photoluminescent
yes.
paint.
Something that would glow in the dark when, mm-hmm. oh, and that also be for the striping on stairs to still having the color and standardizing that so that door would stand out from all the other doors in the building. So that was something we didn't get very far to changing the code to deal with that, but that was something even we had cited representatives on from other groups, stakeholders, who also thought that was a good idea for evacuation. Emergency. So just if it's not in your guideline, maybe something down the road to consider.
Okay. And I think I won't say that it is in there, but I think that's one of the discussions that was held, but it's also being discussed at the ADA, the accessibility guidelines discussions as well. So those are things that we want to make sure that we're taking care of. We want to provide protections within buildings for all citizens that use buildings. So all those things that we can do to make it easier for people to access buildings, to make their way through buildings, and avoid hazards in buildings are what we want to achieve within the body of this standard and the work that we do with other organizations as well. Finally, I'd really like to thank you for the opportunity to come out here and speak to you today. The Institute is all about trying to get information in the hands of the citizens of this country and also to make sure that they know that there are, in fact, there is work that's going on that we believe can assist them in terms of their livability in this country. That's what we're all about. That's the kind of task that we have before us. So thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity to come here. I hope I've been able to impart a bit of information for you. If you have comments, please feel free to reach out to me at the National Institute of Building Sciences. It's very easy to get a hold of me. It's just H Green, just like the color, no E on the end, at nibs.org. Thank you so much.
Get in my pocket.
Did you drive here?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you use valet parking?
No, I parked in the rear. I got it. Don't worry about it. It's all good.
Okay. Thank you again for coming.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Pardon me, sir? Just H Green
info@nibs.org. Okay? Pretty simple. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you, folks.
Is Dan Roberts here?
I'm right over here.
Good, Dan.
Ready to go.
Okay. Now we're going to enter the subject of wayfinding access to convention sites, hotels, a variety of other uses. Those of you who may have attended the American Council of the Blind conference and convention had an opportunity then, and now you do too, to try out a wayfinding system that Dan Roberts, the director of the Macular Degeneration Support, has brought and temporarily installed in the hotel using a smartphone and app. And I'm going to turn it over to him so he can explain to you what has been installed and how he can help you in the remainder of the conference and convention to use your smartphone with an app to get around this building. So let's give Dan Roberts a hand.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your interest in learning about this new application. As I expected, it's really been a delight to meet many of you. I recognize many of your faces. I am partially sighted, so I would like to see a show of hands, if you wouldn't mind, to show how many of you have spoken with me about this since you got here. Okay, I thought I recognized some faces there. How many of you have a smartphone, an iPhone in particular? Okay, I'm sorry it has to be an iPhone during this pilot program. All right. And how many of you have actually downloaded the low-vis guide on that iPhone? Okay, so now that helps me gear my talk a little bit so I know. And the rest of you who didn't show hands, you're here for information about what it is, I assume, and how it can help you, right? Okay, I will be done by lunch because I'm going to be hungry too. And I can do all this pretty quickly. So I do want to thank Gene Lozano for what he all the work he did to get me here and to help me map this hotel and get all the logistics done so that we could provide this for you. We are providing it for free, and we're going to continue to do that as long as we can. We're applying for grants and that kind of thing so that you don't have to pay for this. You have to do enough, as we just heard in the last hour. There's enough that we have to put up with without having to also pay for it. So I think we have a right to these kinds of wayfinding techniques. I hope you're as excited as I am, because you're on the ground floor of the most exciting low vision technology to come along in the last decade. I've been doing this for 21 years now, helping people through MD support to learn about the devices and learn about how to live with this. And so I was here when Mike May first invented the outdoor GPS, portable GPS, which is through Sendero Group. He and I have become friends, and we're going to be working on indoor technology together now. I just talked to him on the phone, and we've set up a time where we're going to get together and do our best to get this everywhere, not just portable, which is what I'm doing now to fill in the gap, not just a portable system for low-vision conferences, but in grocery stores, in hospitals, in subways, shopping centers, everywhere. And hopefully it's going to become the law of the land. It should be, shouldn't it? So you're on the ground floor of that. You're actually here before it is even known about. And that's because we're just a little ahead of the game here, and that's okay. It's better to be on top of these things. So I would appreciate your feedback during this next few days if you're using it. And let me know, because that's how I learn. I learned from your sound technician back there on the first day that we can improve the sound of the tone that guides you to the different locations, that it's too sweet, and it gets covered up by exterior noise. So he, knowing his sound technology very well, said, how about changing that so that it has more partials or more overtones so that it can be heard better? And so I'm going to work on that as soon as I get home. This is the kind of feedback I would like to hear from all of you who are using this. So If you have any questions, let's hold those to the end, and I will not take very long to go through this for you and try to give you as much information as I can, and then I'll be happy to answer questions until we all start to starve to death and need to get to lunch. So I am a retired music and drama teacher, of all things. I'm not a geek, a technological geek at all. It's just that I had to retire because of my vision in my late 40s, and so I was looking for something to fill my days. And once I got over the shock and the denial and all the other grief processes of losing your vision and having a family still to raise and a job to keep, I ended up getting into this work, which I found, teaching is a valuable thing, but this has turned out to be even more valuable in my mind. And so it was a blessing in disguise that I was able to have the opportunity to help people like me. I like to tell people that I want to be the guy who I wish was standing at the door of the doctor's office when I walked out after that first time. I needed help, and I didn't have it. And so that's what we're doing our best to do here. You almost have to get a kick in the pants before you realize, hey, people need help out there for these things. Let's get busy. And so that's what we're doing. So because of my own need for support and information, I did found the Macular Degeneration Support in 1995 and have been busy filling my days now with projects like this to do what I can about the situations that we find ourselves in. I don't have employees. It's my wife and me. I have a home office, but I do have about 1,000 volunteers. Those are internet people and people in retirement centers out there who I can call upon. We have over 150 retirement center support groups, and I can ask any one of them at any time to help me do something like fill out a survey, give me your opinions, join this clinical trial, and they're right there ready to help. And I count the Council of the Blind as some of those people, because you're helping me during this next few days by helping me figure out this indoor technology. And I appreciate you being part of MD support now. I'll pay you exactly 10% of everything I get paid for doing this, for doing all that work for me. Several events are featuring this technology as part of our program, including the Americans with Disabilities National Symposium. That was the very first one. We did the annual conference of the American Council of the Blind in Dallas. How many of you were there? 1, 2, 3 people. Okay. the California Council of the Blind, how many of you have been there? Yeah, okay, raise your hands. Yeah, you're all here. Okay. And the Pennsylvania Council of the Blind will be there in a couple of weeks, and the Blinded Veterans Association down in Louisville, and the Guide Dogs for the Blind up in Portland. So my wife and I have been getting around quite a bit. And next year, we, based upon the success of this current pilot program, we're going to cut the program in half now. As far as I'm concerned, it's not a pilot anymore. It's working. And we will be adding up to 7 more conventions here in the States and in Canada next year. And so we're getting some help to do that. We're going to continue to apply for grants and make sure that this gets around. In the meantime, we're going to be doing our best to encourage the commercial side of things to get this into their businesses everywhere they can. And we need your help on that. If you're using it here and you like it, then you have the most influence of anybody. You can say, if you want me to come back to your grocery store, you'll get indoor wayfinding technology because the store down the street is getting it. Put a little pressure on them, and they will listen because it's very simple to put in. It doesn't cost that much to put in and have ready for you, and there's no reason why they shouldn't do that. And so let's all get together and start encouraging companies to start using this. It's similar to portable geographic positioning systems and apps that you might be familiar with, like Blind Square, Seeing Eye, Foursquare, Trekker Breeze. I could go on. There's a bunch of them. Those are portable outdoor GPS systems. Using mapping technology and satellite localization, those products can guide us to the doors of just about any place we want to go. But what do we do after we pass through the door? That was the problem. What do we do when we get inside and there's no satellites? Well, they can't help us at all, so we have to ask for help. We have to then go out and round up volunteers to sit at the volunteer table and be ready to jump up and help people get where they want to go. That's not an easy job, as the gentleman on my right will tell you, that, to get that coordinated and get people trained to do that job well. With something like this, you could be independent and not need that kind of service. That means those people who are kind enough to do the volunteering can be used in other capacities, and there's never enough people to take care of those capacities. The new technology is making it possible for our smartphones to fill the need, and that is the need for how do we get around inside of a building. We call it indoor wayfinding, or we call it indoor navigation. You're already going to see it soon, within the next couple of years, in shopping malls. I think the Great Mall is going to have it within the next year or so. There are subway stations in London right now. I know we're not there, but they have it in their subway stations. Hospitals, the VA hospital, I was talking to them yesterday, the national office, they're interested in putting it into their hospitals. If they do it, the other hospitals probably will fall in line and also put it in. Amusement parks, Disney World already has a system like this. Museums, every place that people sighted or unsighted are going, and where people need help getting around. Unfortunately, a lot of those are mainly designed for sighted people. They are a GPS with a route shown on a map on a screen to get you from Space Mountain to the Princess's Castle. You know, you look at your screen just like on a car, and you walk to it watching that map. That's not going to help us too much. So the difference between that and low-vis guide is this one talks to you. It tells you what's around you, just like the outdoor GPSs do, and it'll also guide you to there. Just let me turn this on a minute and let you listen to it.
Close to Trillium B. Close to volunteer table and low-vis guide support. Close to Trillium B. Trillium C ahead 23 feet. To emergency guide dog relief 2 ahead 24 feet.
As you're walking around the building, that's what it's doing. It's gabbing and talking your leg off, and you just wish you'd be quiet for a minute. It's like...
To emergency guide dog relief 2 left 31 feet.
Yeah, when I used to do the driving, this was my wife.
Close to Trillium B. Emergency exit ahead 51 feet.
Okay.
Close to volunteer table and low-vis guide support.
It keeps telling you where you are, where you're going, and how far away it is. And then if you want to get someplace, and I'll tell you more about that, how to actually operate the thing. The very first person to use this, I've told this story, I told it in Dallas, but it was a man named Bill DeMaio who attended the Atlanta event, the very first one we did with this device. He had his dog Isaac, a golden retriever, in the middle of the Hyatt Regency Hotel's pre-conference area. I asked him, would you try this? He took it, I showed him how to use it. And neither of them had ever set foot or paw in that room before. But after simply listening to his iPhone for a minute or so, Bill was able to mentally map the entire floor without moving. Not only areas that were within normal sight, he also described the locations of rooms and points of interest that were on the other side of the walls surrounding us. It was very exciting when I heard his voice say, hey, I can even see better than a sighted person. I can see through the walls. Then he turned toward the registration table 50 feet away and around the corner. He healed his dog because he didn't need the dog to assist him, took him to the exact location. Now, healing the dog is not the best idea in the world because you still need the dog for safety. I can't tell you where all the chairs are, and I can't tell you where they set up a coffee bar, you know, all of a sudden. That's not on the map. Sometimes there's pillars. I try to put the pillars on the maps. But the dog is there, and your cane are there to help you be safe. And so that's the first priority. If you don't have a human assistance, you must keep those things at the forefront. This guide is new technology. It doesn't always work exactly the way it should. It might be a few feet off, and that could be hazardous. So you do want to keep that in mind, that this is a machine, not a thinking person or you that can keep your own self safe. So he did go to that table. It took him to the exact location with Isaac following him and looking at him like, what are you doing? Bill was therefore able to teach Isaac very quickly about the area so that both of them could create their own individual mental maps, as you know the dogs do, and they both became independent of anyone else's help. That was the first time I ever saw that work, and it was amazing. I mean, I got chills. I still get chills thinking about it, and the look on Bill's face when he realized that he could see even better than a sighted person. And later, I actually saw him giving directions to a fully sighted woman. She said, "I've always been directionally challenged. I need this too." I hope you've been following the news and the webcasts about low-vis guide during these last few months, and I hope it's encouraged you to dive into the smartphone technology if you haven't done so already. There's so much we can do with it. Daily activities that just a few years ago required us to purchase individual expensive software or hardware. I'm sure you remember those days. Everything cost $100, right? Up to $400, $600. Now you can get it on a smartphone. You can get magnification, time telling, reading printed text out loud. You can recognize colors and currency. You can type by dictation. Find the way. You can find your way now with a cell phone. Surf the web. You can listen to music. You can play games. You can chat with people. You can make free phone calls all around the world, and you can even monitor your own health and your exercise. And now they even have an app where you can monitor your vision. And it reports it to your doctor, who says, "Oops, I see something wrong. Come on in." This is amazing technology, and it's only happened in the last 10 years. So all of these can be accomplished with a single smartphone, and that includes getting your way around this convention right here today. If you don't happen to have a smartphone, and I understand why, it's new, it's something you have to learn, it's expensive, there's lots of good reasons for not having them, and if you have a spouse like I do who's a wonderful guide, sometimes you say, "Let me just do it the easy way. She'll be with me. I can depend upon her." But then she wants to go shopping once in a while without me and leaves me alone. And so I say, okay, now I still have something that can get me around. And so it's something that you might want to think about. The cost of the smartphone, they can break it down. By the way, you don't need to buy a contracted cell phone. That's where the expense is. If you just get your granddaughter's old 4S smartphone that she's not using anymore because it is not up to date and she won't be seen walking around junior high with that old smartphone, say, "Give it to Grandma because Grandma can use this." And when you get here, you don't need Wi-Fi. You don't need cell. We have beacons all over the place that Chris and I put up 2 days before you got here. Those are your satellites. That's your Wi-Fi, and that's all you need. And any cell phone will work. So an old used cell phone, as long as it's 4S and higher, or an iPad, or a mini pad. Is that what they call them? I don't think so, no. The little iPads can work with this. So check out your granddaughter's and grandson's iPad supply. They probably have several lying around. After those people who have been using it, who raised their hands a minute ago, after they have installed the app and turned on the voice and the Bluetooth features that are already available on the phone, they open the guide. It automatically begins speaking to you, just like you heard a minute ago. It tells you distances of points of interest, what we call POIs for short, within an adjustable range of 16 to 328 feet, even through the walls. People with some functional eyesight will see displayed on their screens lists and directions and distances, plus a map showing the localization and the routes, just like a GPS in a car. For those who can't see the screen, it identifies the POIs, their direction, and how many feet away they are. And when the user, meaning you, decides where they want to go, they tell the smartphone by either typing or speaking or selecting the name of the POI, and they begin walking. As you walk, you're listening to the guide describing where you are and how far you still have to go. At the same time, you're listening to an audible tone. This is what's unique. And you're feeling your phone vibrate to get you there and keep you on track. I'm going to real quick find that so you can hear that tone. Let's say we want to go to the emergency guide dog relief exit, which is right outside the door. I click on go to, I turn up the volume.
Close to Trillium C. Next turn, behind you 36 feet. Close to emergency guide dog relief 2. Next turn, behind you 36 feet. Trillium C left 19 feet. Next turn, right 19 feet. Close to Trillium B.
In the direction
guide support right 15 feet.
Of the exit.
Right 19 feet.
Be quiet. There she goes. I turned the iPad, and you heard the tone go down and disappear. That meant I was on track. As long as you don't hear it, you're going the right direction. As soon as you start going to the left or the right, it goes, okay? It even starts to vibrate. And so you know, oops, something's wrong. So you adjust your direction, and you get it to be quiet and quit vibrating, and you get there. Now, some of you have already tried this, and you know it works. 90% of the time is technology. When you get there, it should say you've reached your destination. It should throw up balloons and play music. I think I'll have it do that. Give it a little celebration party because you just did that all by yourself. In Portland a few weeks ago, I took a man's dog away from him with his permission, and I left him with only his cane and my smartphone. And I said, okay, I want you to go to the elevators out in the lobby. And that must have been 300 feet away. He started walking. He's 87 years old, so he walked kind of slow. I followed him with his dog, and he made every turn correctly. It was amazing. He looked like a teenager listening to his tunes. He had his earbuds in, you know, he's walking along, listening to his phone, and as far as anybody knew, he was just listening to his music while he was walking. And as one lady told me earlier in the year, she said, you know what, I don't look visually impaired anymore. I look like everybody else. And kids love this. They don't want to walk around school looking visually impaired with huge headphones and all kinds of devices hanging all over them like they used to. Now they have a smartphone, which is really cool if you're 8 years old and you have your own smartphone. And they're walking across the yard, the playground, and getting around things and walking past things and getting into the building, and they're doing it all with GPS, and they don't look any different than any other child. And that's amazing. So we still have a ways to go to make this perfect, but right now, as I like to say, it's better than nothing. Actually, it's a lot better than nothing at this point. So whether you're sighted or partially sighted or blind, I hope that Low Vis Guide will make your time here easier and more efficient. If you don't have a smartphone, come see me and I'll let you play with mine so you can see how it works. And you might be encouraged to buy a smartphone for yourself. You can download the free application. It is free. You can learn how to use it all by going to mdsupport.org. That's my website. Also, complete instructions are on there, which I also have printed out here on my table right outside the door. I also have a QR code on there so you can take a picture of it with your barcode reader and listen to the instructions. And so try to make it as easy as possible to learn how to use this. That's your manual. And if you need additional help, there's a volunteer table, and that's me right outside the door. I'm there from 8 to 5 through the end of this convention. I love meeting people and helping them with this because I just love to see the smiles on their faces when they find out they just got someplace without any help. It's a joy to watch. Does anybody care? We have about 20 minutes to 12 here. Does anybody care how it works enough for me to go into that now? What's making it work? Okay, really quickly, it is low energy beacon technology. These are beacons, and they're all over the place. They're about 120 feet apart, 10 feet off the floor. They stick on the wall, and they come down very easily. Otherwise, the hotel wouldn't let me stick them on the wall. And they are little radios, is what they are, and they're putting out a signal. And you're always being triangulated. You're always in a place, if I put them upright, you're always being seen by at least three beacons at the same time in three different directions around you, which means it's localizing you. It's finding you, just like satellites do when you're outside. And then it already knows where all the rooms are because last week I mapped all this while I was at home. I got the floor plans from the hotel and then mapped all the locations of all the rooms. Gene sent me all the information, the descriptions of where the guide dog relief areas were. I got all that ahead of time, mapped it on the map. Takes about 12 hours to do that. It's not a big job. It's kind of fun, actually. And by the time I got here, the app knew where everything was. Now all it needed to know was where you are. So my wife, Chris, and I put up the beacons the night we got here, a couple nights ago, and then we had to walk around the hotel and actually upload the coordinates of every 8 feet of every floor in every meeting room. That takes a little while, and we look a little silly. Two old people stand there looking at their cell phones and standing stock still for 15 seconds while this uploads with people trying to get around us, and they think, what's wrong with these old people? You know, are they lost? said, far from it. And so that's what we did, and that took several hours to do that. We don't do the insides of the meeting rooms because once you're in here, you know where you are, and it would take forever for us to do the insides. Same thing with restrooms. Once you're in there, you're kind of on your own. I hope you can get back out again. And she's still talking to me. What is wrong with that woman? There we go. Put her over there. The walkways around. Now, I do need to apologize for the lobby. They were constructing when we were here putting it up. It was a mess. They had, all kinds of things going on. There was no way we could localize the lobby, and they didn't even have a floor plan. Otherwise, we would have also done the lobby where you could have found your way around the lobby with this. But the best I could do then was simply put, if you're listening to it, go to the exit of this foyer here, the Trillium foyer, and right at the exit, it tells you how to get to everything in the lobby. If you don't mind standing there listening to it, it'll tell you how to get to the Apollo room, how to get to the elevators, the front desk, the guide dog exit, and that kind of thing. So that's the best we could do there. When you're in the lobby, you're kind of on your own, like the old-fashioned way. And then when you get into the meeting areas again, you will be picked up again by the beacons. So that's how the thing works. And I think I've pretty well covered everything, so what I'll do, because as I said, we're getting hungry here, we've been here a long time. If you want information step by step, stop by and pick them up, the printed ones with the QR codes on them, or go to my website, you can hear them there, and learn how to do this. It's a learning curve, not a large one, but a little bit of learning, and I tell people, who complain about having to learn how to do it, I say, well, you had to learn how to use your cane, didn't you, when they gave you that, and then you had to learn how to use your dog, and now you need to learn how to use the technology, and it's really very simple to use once you've done so. So I'll take this now, it's about 20 till now, and so any questions at all about anything? Do we need a mic runner here? Oh, she's back there. Okay.
I'm one of those guys that downloaded the app and then forgot to get the instructions before I left home. Can you give us a very brief explanation? I saw the three tabs, and I tried typing something in the search box, and I could see the list of points of interest, but I couldn't actually get directions as to how to get there. Could you run through that very quickly?
Yeah, one of the main things that I insisted upon when I had the company who built this for me was to keep all of the buttons in the same place no matter what screen you're on, so you didn't have to keep looking for them. The search button is in the upper left. You hit that and you get the list of all of the rooms in the meeting areas. And then in the upper right is a personal assistance button. If you select that one, you can actually filter out and look only for food or only for restrooms. You can categorize. In a small area like this, I wouldn't use that because there aren't that many rooms. But if you're it's a large convention, that's a very handy feature to filter it. You can also call me. So if I had a lady stuck in the corner one time. She was stuck in a corner. She had no idea where she was. And she hit the call for help button, and I was there in 2 minutes from my table, and I guided her out and showed her how to get out of that corner. So that's what that's for. Please don't use it after the convention. I can't come from Kansas City and help you get out of the corner. So it's just for this convention. And down at the bottom, there are tabs along the bottom of the screen. The first one is the map view. If you have some vision, would like to use the map. It's very tiny on a small screen. On an iPad, it's a little better. That's for visual people. The second tab at the bottom is the POI function. That's where you'll get the list, which VoiceOver reads to you constantly, and that's what this voice was doing earlier. She was reading that list of places. And then the third tab is a settings, where you can change the how it tells you your directions. It can do clock face directions, or it can tell you in what we call cardinal directions, left, right, in front of, or behind. Whichever your preference is there. So those are the only buttons on there to deal with. Okay, the routing, we call that the routing. So let's say you want to go to the restroom from here. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. You go to either find it in the list by scrolling down to restrooms and then select restrooms, and then it will give you all the choices of restrooms. So it narrows it down to just restrooms, and then select the choice that you want. The other way, which is a little faster, if you're good at this, is hit the search button, and it'll open up a search field where you can type in or dictate restroom. And all you have to do is say rest, and it'll fill in the rest. Now, that was kind of clever. And then you scroll, you'll get a window, and the window will open up and describe more in detail what it is you selected, like whether they're which way is it to the men's room, or is it the one on the left or the right? It'll tell you that. Anything else that you need to know, it'll tell you what hours it's open, for example. If it's a restaurant, it'll say it opens at 9, it closes, and so on. It'll even give you a menu sometimes if I put that in there. Details about the POI. And then you hit go to. And when you do that, that tone starts that you heard a while ago. Then you follow the tone and you're there. Did that answer your question? Okay, it's the you may not realize there's a screen there. The screen is a description and hours of operation. Yeah, and right under that is a favorites button and a go-to button. And so select the go-to, and that'll take you there. Another question over here?
Yeah, is this basically a throwaway situation that, like, when the event is over, would the app have any additional value, or do we just delete it?
Just throw it away, because unless there's some other place where I am or I've set it up, it's not going to work.
Well, let's say I don't plan to do this, but let's say, for example, I planned to go to Pennsylvania, which I believe is your next stop. If I kept the app on the phone, would it work when I got to the event in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Okay.
Any place this is advertised, low-vis guide, it'll work. You may have to re-download it. You may have to update it, because I'll be changing the maps. Another question over here? Just one second. There's a lady here right in front of me who's got... Never mind. She's coming over with you.
Does it work here in this room so that you can get out?
I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Does it work in this room?
In the rooms?
No, this particular room.
No, it won't work inside the meeting rooms. Okay.
I lose people. So when I'm with somebody, they disappear. Is there some way that I can track those people through this app? So I'll know if they're on that side of the wall or this side of the wall?
Track a person instead of a room?
Both. Can I do it simultaneously?
Only if I knew where they were and I mapped them.
So a moving target?
No, it won't find a moving target. Now, there are apps that'll do that. You can, not apps, but it's a little, it's called Stick and Find. And it's a little quarter-sized thing that you can stick on your cat or your car keys, and you'll always be able to find them.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's a you're getting colder, you're getting warmer kind of a thing. You know, as you get, and it's an app on your computer, on your phone, which is free when you buy the Stick and Find stickers. And they're like $2 a piece or something. And you can buy 4 or 5 at a time and just stick them on everything around the house. I stuck one on myself one time and told my wife to find me. She did. Took her a while. I was hiding in the garage. That's the next best thing to what you're talking about there. But this app won't do that.
Will it eventually? Will it all be?
Probably not, because it has to be on the map. And that's quite a process, is to get it mapped.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. We got about 5 minutes, and it looks like one more question back there. Oh, two more questions. All right.
So if I wanted it to be done in the grocery store and was talking with the folks at the grocery store, how much is it for them to put it in, or how does it work?
I can't speak for that, really, because I'm doing this for nothing. So I actually have no idea what I would charge if I had to do this commercially. I would guess, for us to do it, now I'll be open with you, for us to do it, we have to pay for our transportation, our lodging, and everything else. So what I put in on the grant money is that it cost me about $5,000 to come and do this. And so that can be done for $5,000. If we can do this for $5,000, we could certainly do a grocery store. You know, that'd be easy. So it'd be, but companies are going to want to make money. You know, so they're not going to want to just pay their expenses, and that only covers expenses. I would guess $10,000 to $15,000 to do a decent-sized space. if it's a shopping mall, it could be thousands and thousands of dollars because those are huge. But what they're doing there is the stores are paying for it because they get to advertise on this. Where mine says it's open from hours something to something. See, they can put an advertisement there, and they can say our sale today is, and here's where you find it, and the app will take you right to the lingerie department where you can find their sale. So it's pretty neat.
How much is the little beacon? How much is it, 25
Those
cents?
Beacons are $20 a piece.
$20 a piece?
Yeah.
Okay, that gives an idea.
Yeah, so if you find one lying around, please give it back to me. We've lost 15 of them, not here, but during the summer, and that gets expensive. Okay. I don't see any more. Well, there's one more. I do. I have stickers on them that says return this to the information desk, but sometimes I don't know why they don't return them. I guess they're too much fun to have. All right. Yes.
Let's give Dan Roberts a big hand.
Thank you.
And very much appreciate Dan and his wife coming to California to set this up for us. I got to experiment this in National, and in a few weeks I hope to buy a 6S smartphone and leave my flip phone, which Dan helped me at convention with my flip phone. So, but it's a very valuable, and it's try it out, even if you don't have a smartphone, really try it. Meet with Dan and give it a try. It's the way of the future. So again, thank you everyone and for coming, and hopefully this you enjoyed the workshop and have a good lunch. And remember that our first general session starts at 1:30 in this room. Thank you. Bye.